Everyone talks about innovation, new tools, new tech, the next big thing. In bone health, innovation didn't start at the cutting edge. It started much earlier, with people who asked better questions, pushed against the grain, and brought bone health into focus when few others were paying attention. Originals is a series about those people, not just researchers, the builders, the ones who shaped the field from the ground up. In these one-on-one conversations, we sit down with the architects of modern bone health to trace where we've been and where we might go next. No nostalgia, no fluff, just the raw history told by the people who made it. This is Originals, a special series from the Bone Health Basement Tapes. Well, welcome back to the Bone Health Basement Tapes, episode 2 of our original series. I'm Peter Bianco. In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Michael McClung, founding director of the Oregon Osteoporosis Center, board member of the American Society of Osteoporosis Providers, and recipient of the 2025 ASBMR Frederick C. Barter Award. A pioneer in the field, Dr. McClung has spent over 4 decades leading groundbreaking trials, shaping global guidelines, and changing how we think about fracture prevention. Welcome to the basement, Dr. McClung.
Well, thank you. A great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and we're really excited that you're here. The original series is our way to look back at, the history of bone health and those that actually built it, as we're also looking really far forward as to what is the future of bone health. And so we really appreciate your input today. And how I'd like to start this and what we do with all of our podcasts is with people we interview is like, tell us how you got here. Give us your background, your history, and what got you to be interested in bone health and brought you to where we are today.
Good. That I will enjoy telling that story because it's not the usual pathway. So I did my medical training in Dallas at the Southwestern Medical School. And I fell in love with endocrinology. And near the end of my residency, the chief of medicine tapped me on the shoulder one day and asked, how would I like to be a thyroid doctor? He needed a thyroid specialist on the faculty. So he wound up arranging for me to go to the NIH to do my endocrine fellowship, where I was in the thyroid branch and worked with the thyroid cancer specialist there. My first project was reintroducing thyroid aspiration biopsies back into the United States in a paper we wrote in 1977. And at the end of fellowship, I realized I didn't need to live in Texas the rest of my life. In the NIH, there were rivers and hills and trees. And so it wound up, I was recruited to come to the University of Oregon Medical School in Portland, where I'd never been to Oregon before, and I came to set up the thyroid cancer unit at the medical school. As usual, as I arrived in January of 1976, the next month I was assigned to be the consulting physician at the VA hospital, and I saw a patient who had Paget's disease of bone and hypercalcemia. It was the thinking at the time that patients with high turnover states like Paget's disease could develop hypercalcemia just from that high turnover state. But two things changed my thinking about that. One, for some reason that I don't recall, I went to a meet the professor session at the Endocrine Society meeting in San Francisco the summer before, and a wonderful clinician, Saul Posen, from Sydney, Australia, talked about Paget's disease and his several hundred patients he had seen. And he made the comment that he thought that hyperparathyroidism occurred more frequently than he would have anticipated.
Right, right.
Somehow I remembered that. Secondly, my last rotation at the NIH, my last clinical rotation, was with Dr. Barter, which we'll come back to. And One of his fellows, Art Brodus, had just described the fact that measuring cyclic AMP in the urine helped distinguish hyperparathyroidism from cancer-related hypercalcemia. Uh-huh. I had in this was before we could measure parathyroid hormone in assays. I had invented a cyclic AMP assay at the NIH to study the effect of TSH on thyroid slices. So when I saw this patient, I remembered those things. I collected the man's urine sample, stopped by the hospital clinical laboratory on the way back to my lab to pick up a bunch of samples off the shelf to use as controls. You could never do that today. And over the weekend, I measured the patient's urinary cyclic AMP, found it to be high, made the diagnosis of hyperpara. He went to surgery. His adenoma was resected. His hypercalcemia went away. His Paget's disease got dramatically better. And by that accident, I became the calcium doctor at the medical school.
Well, the accident of history, you know, rears its head, right?
So at the NIH, I trained one floor below the famous calcium group headed by Jerry Auerbach. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, many talented people in his lab, including John Delazikian, Al Spiegel, Stephen Marks, Ed Brown, famous people in the calcium field, were all there. But I was on in the thyroid branch and wasn't really connected with calcium until this patient. And over the next several months, once it became known that I was interested in seeing calcium problems, the endocrine clinic at the medical school got overwhelmed with referrals of calcium problems. So much so that I had to start a clinic, you know, the bone and mineral clinic. And fortunately, when I arrived in Portland, a young man named Eric Orwell was a resident at one of the hospitals, and he had chosen for his resident project the evaluation of urinary cyclic AMP and differentiating hypercalcemic mm-hmm. states. So mm-hmm. his mentor introduced us, and I helped him with that project. He then came to the medical school to do his fellowship in endocrinology. And with Eric, who turns out, of course, to be the world's expert about osteoporosis in men, he and I started the Bone and Mineral Clinic in early 1977, long before osteoporosis was cool.
Well, I haven't even graduated from high school at that point. So.
We were in the ground floor. So we hardly saw osteoporosis patients. We saw Paget's patients, and they were large families in Oregon with X-linked hypophosphatemic rickets or vitamin D-resistant rickets. And we saw lots of parathyroid problems. And the only osteoporosis patients we saw were older women who had a recent vertebral fracture, and they were referred for pain management, mm-hmm. not for medical management, because we, you know, in those years, we didn't even have a definition of what osteoporosis was. We certainly didn't have any diagnostic tools, nor drugs known to be effective. And the first drug approved for treating osteoporosis was calcitonin in 1984, long after we'd already started our clinic. So it was seeing patients with osteoporosis was depressing at the time, because I would see a healthy, vigorous 60-some-year-old woman who had a vertebral fracture. 2 years later, she would have another fracture, and a year later, another one. And as a consequence, she would develop kyphosis, height loss, right. and become an old lady in front of us. It was a depressing thing to deal with. So when the availability first of single photon absorptiometry, a bone density test that measured bone density in the forearm,
right,
became commercially available, I used my limited personal funds to buy a machine. And Eric and I began studying patients. At the end of his fellowship, we tried to figure out how to get the VA to continue to fund his research activity. And in a a sleazy hamburger joint over a beer and greasy French fries, he and I dreamt up the idea of measuring bone density in men, which had not been done before. And we did the first study of measuring bone density in men. And he, again, as I mentioned, he's gone on to become the world's expert about the epidemiology, the pathophysiology, and the management of osteoporosis in men.
So is this obviously what led to the Oregon Osteoporosis Center?
Yeah, so we started that clinic.
Right.
And it grew over time. I stayed at the medical school another 10 years or 11 years, and then was recruited to move across town to a private hospital that had a very academically oriented internal medicine residency program. Mm-hmm. So I was recruited to join that as a part of the faculty. The head of that program had been a fellow when I was an intern at Parkland Hospital. So I knew him. And so I moved across town with our osteoporosis center in 1987. That was the year DEXA was introduced.
Okay.
And the availability of DEXA did two things. First of all, it allowed pharmaceutical companies to evaluate treatments with an endpoint that could be measured. Measurement of bone density in the forearm was not useful because almost none of our treatments affect forearm bone density. So it was not useful in monitoring response. We had a dual photon absorptiometer that was invented by the Lunar Company in 1985.
Right.
But the quality of scans and the reproducibility was not good enough to be used in clinical trials. You had to squint really hard to be able to imagine the image of a hip or a spine on the DPA scan. So not surprisingly, Merck, who had alendronate on their shelf, and Procter & Gamble, who had invented residronate, as soon as DEXA became available, they recognized that they could begin doing clinical trials.
Right.
And particularly phase two trials, where you look at different doses to choose the dose to carry over into phase three trials. And then the study of osteoporotic fractures that Steve Cummings had organized initially they were measuring forearm bone density and heel ultrasound bone density. They then adopted DEXA as a part of their program and were able to, for the first time in 1983, show us that bone density was actually a risk factor or a predictor of fracture risk. But we didn't know that before. We didn't know that the tests that we had available. So the combination of documentation that bone density predicted fracture risk, and then the utility of DEXA in phase two clinical trials sort of started the whole process of osteoporosis drug development. And by the time the phase two study for alendronate was being planned, we already had a large osteoporosis center. We'd already had experience with DEXA. I had developed a quality control program for monitoring that. And we were invited to be one of the six study sites for the phase two study. And my late wife, Betsy, who was the nurse and coordinator of our clinic, helped us recruit patients. We recruited more than anybody else did. And that then opened the door for us being invited to be a part of virtually every large osteoporosis clinical trial from that point forward, all the way up through the romosozumab or Evenity trials.
Well, that must have been a very exciting time to be a part of. And it seems to me like a lot of times you don't realize how good that is until after, you know, looking back on it. But that must have been, I mean, what was going through your mind at that time relative to we're really onto something, or, you know, this is groundbreaking and exciting and all that? I mean, what was happening then?
It was a very exciting time. So as I finished my fellowship, the vitamin D metabolic pathway had just been unraveled. The idea that there was an activation of vitamin D.
That,
and then the technology for measuring hormones in serum with radiation assay developed. So suddenly we could measure all of these things that people had dreamt about before, and learning how that fit into clinical evaluation by itself was very exciting. And then as the clinical studies began and we began to understand that we could influence bone metabolism in a way that improved bone density and ultimately improved bone strength, it was a heady time. And there's a whole generation of us that were all in this together. So people like, again, John Belisikian, Nelson Watts, Steve Harris, Marjorie Lucky, a number of others, we were all the same vintage, all equally excited and interested and wonderfully supportive of each other. And I think because this was so new and there was so much to learn and so much to do, the whole idea of competitiveness simply didn't happen among those of us in those years, which made it be really exciting to be learning together with everybody.
That's great. And I think that from the work, the look at this, and that this era led to a number of landmark contributions on your part in clinical trials, guideline development, and then your ongoing interest in continuing in education of the next generation as well. But at this point, I'd like to bring in Dudley Phipps, who is the president and executive director of the American Society of Osteoporosis Providers, to kind of take us a little bit further into the weeds on your clinical trial experience and all the other things that have gone on since. Dudley?
Sure. Hi, Pete. Hi, Dr. McClung.
Hi, Dudley.
So, Dr. McClung, tell me about, tell me about the studies into alendronate and how that got started. How did Merck come up with that idea? And what was that clinical trial process like for you?
Yep. Well, the whole bone program at Merck was headed by a fantastically brilliant scientist, Gideon Rodin, who had come from Yale, I think, to head up the bone program. Bisphosphonates had been invented back in the 1880s by a German chemist to be anti-scaling agents in industry. But then people at Procter & Gamble and people collaborating with colleagues in the UK had figured out that because bisphosphonates inhibited bone mineralization, that they might be useful in treating ectopic calcification syndromes, like dystrophic calcification. And so some early studies in animals were undertaken, and it was appreciated that etidronate, the simplest and first bisphosphonate, inhibited bone resorption. And that then led to the development of a whole family of bisphosphonates by Italian and other European laboratories. And Merck had purchased alendronate, which seemed to be one of the the good one. So Gideon came and then hired some very good clinicians, including Art Santora and David Karp and others, who then planned the clinical development program. And they did a fantastic job. Merck had a long history of knowing how to do clinical trials with their statins, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first, after the initial dosing in individual patients was done in the phase one studies, the next important study is a phase two study where you try to find out what the appropriate dose is. And Merck planned a very good, well-designed phase two study with doses from 2.5 up to 20 milligrams a day being evaluated, and showed that a dose of 10 milligrams a day was at the top of the dose response curve if you used bone density as the outcome. And so in recruiting women to be a part of that study. Again, osteoporosis was becoming more discussable in the general scheme of things.
Yep.
There had been an NIH consensus conference about osteoporosis that the only conclusion they came to was that calcium might be good. And so suddenly, the company that made Tums tablets began marketing Tums as good for bone health. Nobody ever knew that.
You know, I kind of remember this, actually. Yeah.
So, but they and the dairy industry suddenly made it be fashionable for women to wonder what their bone density was, and maybe they could prevent osteoporosis. So we had all these women who had osteoporosis, for which we had no good therapy, who were eager to be a part of a clinical trial that had potential benefits. So it was a very fun and exciting time. And our little group started with four people. We had a secretary, Betsy, the nurse and study coordinator, and a bone density technologist. And over the next 8 or 10 years, we grew to a staff of about 75.
Wow.
And had at one time more than 1,000 individuals in clinical trials that we were following.
Wow.
So we grew to be the largest clinical trial center in North America in the 90s and 2000s. So anyway, it was a heady, exciting time, because every year at the ASBMR and other meetings, we were learning new things. It was very fun to be in the middle of all of that.
Of all, you've been involved in so many clinical trials. Is there one trial that was more memorable or stands out in your mind as a pinnacle of your career?
I don't think any of the trials are the pinnacles. The different trials have different recollections. Probably the one I remember the most is the residerate hip fracture trial that I wound up being the PI for, because of its tortured history. Procter & Gamble, a scientist at Procter & Gamble, had invented resideronate, which I still think is probably the best oral bisphosphonate there is.
Mm-hmm.
But Procter & Gamble was a toothpaste company. They had a very small pharmaceutical division and did not have the experience that Merck had in planning or executing clinical trials. So P&G started out ahead of Merck, but Merck got organized and suddenly presented their phase two results and were planning phase three. And the people at Procter & Gamble essentially panicked, skipped phase two, and planned three giant phase three studies. A vertebral fracture trial, an osteopenia trial, and a hip fracture trial. And they began recruiting for all three studies simultaneously, and not long after realized that they were spending way more money than they could afford. And so they cut back on many of the important parts of the study. So in the hip trial, there were two groups of patients recruited, one group of women in their 70s, who had osteoporosis or who had low bone density. This was before the WHO definition of osteoporosis existed. The other group were women over the age of 80. And originally bone density was to be measured at baseline in all of those women. And they decided that everybody knew that everybody over age 80 had osteoporosis, so we don't need bone density. And that was a huge mistake in retrospect, because at the end of the study, resideronate was effective in reducing fracture risk in the 70-year-olds with low bone density. But in the 80-year-old women who had a risk factor for fracture, it was mostly fall-related risk, there was a 25% hip fracture risk reduction that wasn't statistically significant, that messed up the whole story with resideronate. And that, plus getting the paper published, dealing with people from Europe who, they're in one of the studies, there was a hint of increased lung cancer risk with the lower of the two doses of resedronate studied. That was almost certainly a chance finding. But certain people in Europe who had a bone to pick with Procter & Gamble emphasized that. And so one of the co-authors of the hip fracture trial, after the study had been accepted by the New England Journal, wrote to the editor of the journal and said, the company's hiding data from you about the, so dealing with all of that was another memorable piece of the story. So,
wow.
Wow. All of those things, of course, are behind the scenes, pieces of how the hip fracture trial came to be published in the New England Journal.
Santa Fe just wrapped up. Can you tell me how the Fellows Workshop at Santa Fe got started?
Yeah, I wasn't there at the beginning, but the Endocrine Society, with the input of Dolores Schoback from San Francisco and others, decided that a training program for endocrine fellows about bone disease would be appropriate. Many endocrine fellowship programs don't have a bone component. So that course was put together, and in the third or fourth year, I was invited to become a part of the faculty. When Amgen came on the scene in 2010 with the approval of denosumab and Prolia, they became one of the underwriters of it, and they wanted the program to be connected with a society program somewhere. It had always been a freestanding program. And I made the decision to link it to the Santa Fe Bone Symposium because it was the best clinical program, as opposed to hooking it to ASBMR or the Endocrine Society or something like that.
Right.
A few years after I got started, then I became the director of the program, and I've been so ever since. The Endocrine Society gradually made things more and more difficult for it. So we actually separated from them, and now the program is under the auspices of the Endocrine Fellows Foundation, a wonderful program for fellows. And the support of the EFF and their staff to make the program be good is wonderful. But again, Santa Fe is a great city to have a conference in. I've got to invite friends and colleagues and partners to be a part of the program each year. And it has been a wonderful experience for me to have been a part of. And the payoff is attending ASBMR or other meetings and have somebody come up and say, Dr. McClung, I was at Santa Fe 10 years ago, and my time there is why I became a bone doctor.
That's great.
That's fantastic. So,
but you've been very active on the international stage also. How did that transpire?
I first met people in other countries in part through Merck's convening consultant meetings around the world. So I got to know the leaders of the osteoporosis community in Europe, particularly Klaus Lichtenstein. He and I were investigators together. Pierre Delmas, who we've now lost, but was the first president of the International Osteoporosis Foundation, and John Canis, whom we all know as the father of FRAX. They became colleagues and friends. Because I was willing to travel to Europe, to South America, to Australia, to Taiwan and Korea, I was invited to speak at national and international meetings around the world. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but that turned out to be something I've very much enjoyed and has allowed me to interact with wonderful colleagues in all parts of the world.
Let's change gears a little bit. Cardiology really started taking root in the late 70s. Bone was fairly close behind that. How do we try to reconcile where we're at in the bone space as to where cardiology is today? What did they do right that we didn't necessarily latch on to?
Yeah, that's a very insightful question. And I think there are multiple components. An easy one off the top is that the American Heart Association is a very effective group to promote both knowledge and education for both physicians and patients.
Right.
And so all of heart disease was focused and centered in the American Heart Association. Osteoporosis has not had a similar academic or a clinical home. The National Osteoporosis Foundation was founded in the United States in 1998. There was an equivalent formed in Europe. But at least in the United States, the major objective of the NOF was to have Medicare funding for DEXA testing, driven by Merck's interest in having everybody be measured so that people with low bone density could be identified who would then be candidates for their drug.
Right, right.
And developing appropriate guidelines and clinical pathways was not a part of the NOF's objective. So we got steered off track even at the very beginning. Having a fracture was never made to be considered as a serious event like having a heart attack is.
Mm-hmm.
So, somebody presents to the hospital with a heart attack, a risk assessment protocol is initially undertaken, and everybody goes home with a drug to prevent the next heart attack. That ought to happen for people who present with a fracture. And so for years now, and the residents who attend clinic with me, I've attempted to have them consider an older adult who presents with a fracture as having had a bone attack. And they need to then at least undergo risk assessment, if not management. Mm-hmm. And we've not made that message be clear and not help patients appreciate that having a hip fracture or a wrist fracture or a humerus fracture is more than just an accident that happened because they fell, but that it's a marker of impaired skeletal strength. And we've not made that message be clear and resonate.
So I'm going to make you king for a day. If you were king for a day.
I like that.
Hold All on, right,
Dudley. I like the phrase "magic wand."
If
you had a magic wand,
yeah. So with my magic wand, and I made you king for a day, what would you change from today's bone health environment to bring us into the future?
Well, certainly, I would help everybody appreciate that. The sequence of starting with a bone building drug to improve. I'll back up one step. We need to make sure everyone understands that osteoporosis is not simply low bone density.
Amen.
It's a combination of low bone density and much more importantly, a deterioration and destruction of the skeletal structure Dr. Dempster talked about. Remind me to come back and explain how Dr. Dempster was important for me too.
Right.
But the drugs we normally use, bisphosphonates, even denosumab, are potent anti-remodeling drugs that inhibit bone resorption, but they also inhibit bone formation. And this cannot and do not restore that disordered architecture. Only a bone building drug can do that. And we know that they are superior to anti-remodeling drugs in terms of improving bone density, bone strength, and fracture risk reduction, and that the best treatment is to start with an antibiotic drug for a year or two, followed then by an anti-remodeling drug to maintain the benefit. The idea of step therapy, of starting with an inexpensive drug like alendronate, and then if the response is not adequate, either switching or adding another drug, a strategy so successfully used in the management of hypertension and diabetes, doesn't work for osteoporosis drugs. All of our potent drugs, from denosumab to the bone-building drugs, their effect is muted and blunted if they're given as second-line drugs rather than first-line drugs. And so I think those points would be what I would want everybody to understand. And of course, the pushback from that is the cost of the osteoanabolic drugs. But we know from the studies that, for example, with romosozumab, used for only 12 months, the fracture protection afforded during that 12 months of therapy persists for at least 2 years and probably much longer. And if you take all of that into account, then the cost effectiveness of that strategy is undeniable. The problem, and many countries who have nationalized health insurance programs recognize that and encourage and allow that sequence to happen. The problem in the United States, of course, is that patients transfer from one insurance plan to another, and insurance companies are not eager to front load a treatment that has long-term downstream benefits. So that's the pushback from that idea.
How did Dr. Dempster impact your getting to this point in life?
Yeah. So Dr. Dempster described in the podcast that you guys did with him, which I really enjoyed, the fact that his electron micrographs of normal and osteoporotic bone were on the cover of the first issue of the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research in 1987.
Yep.
Those images instantly made it clear to me what osteoporosis was.
Mm-hmm.
That, again, it was not just bone density. Everybody was focused on bone density at the time. We took advantage of Dr. Dempster. One of the front office people in our clinic in the mid-1990s came to me and suggested that we rent the outside of a city bus in Portland as a patient education messaging platform. So $15,000, you could, wrap a bus and it drove around town for a year. So what I wanted to do was to have a background image that connoted osteoporosis. And I talked to David about getting his images to help us with it, and learned that ASBMR owned the copyright to those images. So David actually took his bone blocks and made new cuts for us and new photomicrographs that we used to do that. And we used that image to both paint the outside of the bus. We've made scarves and bone ties out of those images. And I had the new images he sent to us blown up as 16 by 20 prints that hung in the hall of the clinic. And when a patient came to see me to talk about osteoporosis, I would take her or him out into the hall to show them the images. And those images helped them also appreciate what osteoporosis really was, that it was not just a number.
Picture's worth a thousand words, huh?
Yep. Right.
Yeah. And that whole conversation with Dr. Dempster was just absolutely phenomenal. And so, moving on a little bit, we're very involved in looking at what's next in bone health. And all the new AI devices that are coming online. Well, they're getting through approval, and these are mostly imaging-based devices that can actually look at an X-ray or a CT scan and say, this patient may have a problem, and insert those into workflows, clinical workflows, mm-hmm. where that's never been possible before. And what we're learning is, if we do this, it's going to create a tsunami of newly diagnosed patients that had been flying under the radar for a long, long time. We're right on the cusp of that. But the structural problems that we're dealing with are, is there's no current incentive to do that. And the other thing we're learning is, if you're going to do that, there better be someplace for them to go.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what are your thoughts on that relative to how we get over this current, you know, what we're experiencing is kind of an uphill climb with this, right? But on the other side of it, and what we're doing behind the scenes at ASAP, we've developed a model that we think is going to work in that, and that's scalable, that can go beyond just secondary fracture prevention, which is, you know, traditionally been patient right. has a fracture, you diagnose them with osteoporosis, you treat them. Until the fracture happens, you know, that's just kind of the way it's been in my view, anyways. But now we have this ability to detect the undetectable in a very large way. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about how we should approach that, or you know, just in general, what is your thoughts around all of that?
Well, first, just to reflect on a piece of history. When bone density became available, and particularly after alendronate was approved in the mid-90s, and bone density centers developed around the country, we had a similar tsunami of identifying women with low bone density for whom treatment might be considered. And again, there were too few people to do the evaluation and management. So
right.
we've been
right.
through this once before.
Right.
We didn't solve it or didn't deal with it correctly then. Of course, the whole medical landscape is very different now than it was 30
yep.
years ago.
Yep.
And the strategy and objective of ASOP to help provide an educational platform for advanced care providers to learn how to manage patients with osteoporosis is an important part of that. So again, as those new techniques of identifying patients who have opportunistic or routine chest x-rays or CT scans, if the radiologist puts in the report that the patient is at high fracture risk, if there's nobody to follow up on that, then the whole thing will fall flat.
Right.
So,
right.
Providing then a cadre of providers that are capable of at least taking the initial steps of evaluation and management of the more routine patients is crucial if that's going to be successful. So, I mean, all of us see the field moving in that direction. That's just the normal evolution of what we can accomplish with AI. So I think that's great. Simultaneously, another tsunami is happening from a different direction, and that's the reawakened enthusiasm or interest on the part of young women as they approach menopause to
right.
be managed. And again, 30 years ago, I was involved in as the PI for many of the studies that led to the approval of drugs for the prevention of osteoporosis. And that whole approach has been set aside with the first real guidelines that focus on identifying patients at high risk of fracture as the most appropriate to treat. Then women who were not yet at high risk of fracture, but who are at high risk for developing osteoporosis, was left behind. So, but there's increasing enthusiasm about that. I'm frequently asked to address that specific clinical question at national meeting. So Not only are we going to find more people already at high fracture risk with the AI tools, but we're going to have another group of people who are interested in being managed to prevent osteoporosis from happening in the first place.
Well, and the nexus of that is what we're shooting for, right?
You know,
those two things coming together at just the right time at this moment, I think is...
Well, they both need the same thing. They need appropriate and evidence-based interpretation of the tools we have, the diagnostic tools.
Correct.
And they, again, need platoons of individuals to help manage them. And the latter is a crucial part that has been discussed for decades about how to encourage physicians to adopt bone health as a part of their objective. For with your background in orthopedics, you know that for many years, most orthopedists eschewed that invitation.
They still do for the most part.
They still do.
It's changing a little bit. Endocrinologists back in my era found bone and calcium metabolism extraordinarily interesting and exciting because I assiduously avoided managing diabetes because it was a morass back in those years. The advances now in management of diabetes and obesity has made that be a much more attractive field. So endocrinologists are shunted off in other directions. Rheumatologists were very interested in osteoporosis until biologics came along to distract them from osteoporosis and move on to more exciting things. So for a generation, we've had a void in training clinicians to care for patients with osteoporosis, which is why we old guys are still around. The young people haven't come around to push us off the stage. We're still here.
Well, we hope you're here for a lot longer, too.
So all those things need to be focused on and developed simultaneously.
Right.
If we're going to make this be successful.
Right. We completely agree with that. And my feeling is that, you know, looking at, you know, I come from the technical and business side, you know, from my perspective, osteoporosis is today where diabetes was in 2010, about to explode. I mean, literally explode. Right. And back then, you know, in 2010, it was kind of the same story. But over time, it became apparent at how big it was that it started to attract investors and capital into new technologies. And that had a lot to do, I think, with where diabetes is now. Heavily focused on, heavily invested, We're trying to do the same thing with osteoporosis, honestly, and stimulate that. And I think, you know, part of, you know, with a shameless pitch for ASAP, our whole focus on certification and creating a new subspecialty, if you will, that's got focus and all that,
right,
is where we're going. And as one of the components to making, you know, a real advance here in that, and coupled with the technologies and all these things that are now coming together. So, you know, that's just kind of, and thank you for being on the board and all that. So is there any last thoughts you want to share with our listeners based on our conversation?
Well, yeah, I like your analogy about diabetes in 2010. One important difference is in 2010, new and effective medicines were just beginning to be developed.
Right.
In our field, we've already got really good medicines.
We have them all. It's all here, right?
Right. And we are still learning, but have learned a lot about the ways to optimize the use of the drugs we have.
Right.
The whole idea of sequencing, as we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So and the other thing that's happening, I think that individuals who are now in their 50s and 60s are much more interested in long-term health management than were people of my generation. And so That, I think, will provide a patient centered groundswell of a demand for ways to accomplish what they want to accomplish. And I think that will play in very nicely with the things you've talked about enlarging the clinician pool of developing new ways to identify people at risk, either for fracture or for osteoporosis. So my excitement about the future has been renewed in the last bit.
We're going to need you. We're going to need you.
A decade or so, I was in the doldrums, as was the whole field, as reimbursement and interest and the proportion of patients at high risk of fracture being treated gradually diminished despite the availability of very effective ways. So I'm much more encouraged about what the future holds. And I hope I'm around for the next 50 years to see what's happened over that time.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because it can be discouraging sometimes, you know, trying to push this ball up a hill or this boulder up a hill, and it's either going to pull back on you or we're going to get over the crest. And I think we're right on the verge. I mean, I really do. And, you know, we had the same conversation with Dr. Dempster. He felt the same way about it, and that we're right on the verge of something completely new and exciting. So,
well, yeah, but I think it takes people like you guys who have different backgrounds and a different focus. I mean, the drug companies have convened consulting task forces for the last 25 years and have asked us what we can do to make osteoporosis be sexier or cooler or whatever. and the same group of us have had no answers. But to take advantage, again, of technology, of business sense and understanding, and how the whole picture of osteoporosis and medical management is changing, gives us a new outlook and a fresh outlook. That's what I find encouraging.
Well, Dr. McClung, thank you very much for your time. You know, and thank you for your leadership and your massive contribution to science on this. You know, and we're standing on the shoulders of giants like you here, trying to move this forward. You know, thank you for participating in today's podcast. I think I'm sure our listeners are going to really value this episode. So thank you very much for being here today.
Well, good. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you, guys.
All right.
You bet. Thanks, Dr. McClung.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
The Bone Health Basement Tapes is a co-production of the American Society of Osteoporosis Providers and the Digital Bone Health Study Group. Check us out at theasop.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.